Ladies, how's everyone doing?
Very well.
Well, good. It's a pleasure and honor to have Ira Brander here with us. Ira Brander, as you know, is the Dean of the CJF, Center for Jewish Future at Yeshiva University, and we're very honored to have him here. So we'll learn a little bit together, and then we'll convene for lunch and some time to discuss.
Good. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me to share words of Torah with you. It's a pleasure for me to be here, and to me, this is one of the most important programs that we run that allows women to grow in their learning, especially young women to grow in their learning. And my hope is that, obviously, Talmud Torah is important no matter what, but I hope that we find ways in which that you'll be able to play roles within the larger Jewish community as scholars. And hopefully over lunch we can have a little bit more of a concrete conversation on that. But let's begin to learn. So the topic that I picked to discuss is the role of divine intervention in the halakhic process, the notion of lo b'shamayim hi. We can discuss a little bit to understand. I think this is the cornerstone of the halakhic process, and together hopefully we'll grow in our learning and we'll understand, I think, a very important issue regarding the halakhic process. So let's begin by just opening our sources. So the first source is the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Daf Nun Tes Amud Beis. Anyone familiar with this Gemara? I hope Tanur Shachnai. Familiar with this Gemara? Yeah? Someone just share it with me. Just give me a basic overview of the Gemara for a second. Anyone? Those who said it, please.
They're arguing over whether this oven is Tamir Tamar.
Right.
And
well, whether it can become Mekabel Toma or not. Why? Because a keli can be Mekabel Toma, and a keli has to be something that can hold something, can hold water, something of that nature. But the Tanur Shel Achnai is set up in a way in which all of the sides of it basically have an outer band that keeps it together. So if you cut the band, basically it disbands, so it's not a kli kibul. It doesn't accept water. So the shaila is whether this Tanur Shel Achnai has the status of a keli or not. Thank you. So, all right, go on, please.
So, I believe the Chachamim said yes, it can become Tanur.
Whatever, and Rabbi Elazar disagrees with them.
And it's like a majority on one side and Rabbi Elazar on the other side.
Right.
And he's so adamant that he's right that he brings all these supernatural proofs to show him. He says, if I'm right, you know, let the sea flow, the river flow backwards. If I'm right, let the tree uproot itself. And all these things happen. And
if I'm right, let HaKadosh Baruch Hu say the halacha is like me, right?
The halacha will come out and
right.
Say, and it says, and it does come out and say that he's always right. But the Chachamim answer that you can't bring proofs from any of these supernatural events that lo b'shamayim hi.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a wonderful Gemara. It's really, you know, where you can really build it up. I'm not going through the whole, like, you know, build it up thing. I think we're past the need for me to do that. And then the answer of the Gemara, then again, as was so correctly said, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Sarah.
What Sarah said, that basically Rabbi Elazar tries to prove his point. HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes on behalf of Rabbi Elazar, nevertheless, lo b'shamayim hi. And at the end of the Gemara here, let's look at the last two lines, the Ashkechech Rabbi Nassan Eliyahu. Rabbi Nassan Eliyahu, Amalei, my avik kutshabricha b'hai shaita. Rabbi Nassan asked Eliyahu, what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing at this point, when basically he lost the battle against the Rabbanim? Amalei kachayech, that he was smiling, and he said, Nitzchuni b'nai Nitzchuni. My children have won, my children have won. He highlighted the idea that lo b'shamayim. So this idea of lo b'shamayim is found throughout Shas, throughout the poskim, and what I'd like to do for the next, like, 40 minutes or so is to give you a little bit of a taste of this notion of lo b'shamayim as seen in various different paradigms in the Gemaras, as well as Rishonim and some of the Achronim, and to show you that lo b'shamayim is not totally endorsed 100%. Okay, first of all, you have a Gemara in Temura Daf Tezayin. The Gemara in Temura says that Yoshua, the Balabat, the Master Yoshua, listen, if there are three, you know, do you have any questions before Moshe dies? And Yeshua says, no, I got everything under control. I was with Moshe all these years. Moshe dies, he forgets 3,000 halachas. Amalo Yeshua. So they say to Yeshua, second line in source 2, Sha'al, ask a Kadosh Baruch Hu, ask. He says, I can't do that. Lo ba'shamayim hi. I cannot ask these halachas, even though that we already learned these halachas, these 3,000 halachas. I can't ask them through a divine way because of lo ba'shamayim hi. And therefore, Asniel ben Kenaz needs to relearn them, mitok pipulo, through a dissection of the text, through the dissection of Svara, and therefore they relearn these 3,000 halachas. That's number one. So that's just advocating the approach. The next idea is that there's a Gemara that discusses in Pesachim exactly how you make a how you make kiddush at the Seder, and Hello postens what's called Yat Nahaz, Yayin Kiddush Ner Havdalah and Zman Shachianu. Beis Shammai says something else. So the Gemara says, source number 3, everyone with me? Source number 3, Bahalacha ki divrei Beis Hillel. Bahalacha is like Beis Hillel. Pshita, we know the halacha is like Beis Hillel. The halacha is always like Beis Hillel. The Hanafik Baskol. In fact, it was a Baskol that said the halacha is like Beis Hillel. Why do we need a Brisa? Why do we need a statement in the Gemara to tell us that the halacha is like Beis Hillel? There was a Baskol that told us that. So the Gemara gives two answers. Ebi is saying, well, one answer is Kodem Baskol. The Brisa was written before the Baskol, and therefore it's not a Shaila. Ebi is saying, and another answer is the Acha Baskol. The Brisa is after the Baskol. Aye, what do you need a Brisa for if you have the Baskol? Rabbi Yeshua, it's because we follow Rabbi Yeshua, the Amar Eimashkechem a Baskol. We don't listen to a Baskol. So the Gemara gives two answers here. One answer is the reason why we need a brisa to indicate that we follow Beis Hillel is because this brisa was written before the Paschal. And the second answer is that we need it, but this brisa was written after the Paschal, but we don't pass like the Paschal. Which answer is the dominant answer of the Gemara? The first answer or the second answer of the Gemara? So if you look at the Shairos and Chubas of the Marshal, which I've put down for you, or you look in the Encyclopedia Talmudi, at the page I've cited for you, you'll see that sometimes there are different styles. When you have Inami, when you have other styles, sometimes it's the first answer that's the predominant answer of the Gemara. It's important to know that. But when you have Ibayasema, and you have one answer that starts with Ibayasema, and a second answer that starts with Ibayasema, it's always the second answer that is the dominant answer of the Gemara. So the dominant answer of the Gemara is that the brisa needed to be written even though there was a baskol, because a baskol does not choreograph how we pass it halacha. And we see the same idea in source number 4, where David HaMelech asks the shayla, where David HaMelech asks the Urim Betumim whether he should fight the war against the Pelishtim, and the Gemara asks, why did he have to? How could he do that? He has the base in Shmuel. And the Gemara answers, and Rashi explains, he wasn't asking the Urim V'Tumim whether he can fight the war or not, because he knew the Beis Din of Shmuel told him he has to fight the war. He knew halachically he had to fight the war. He just wanted to know, through divine intervention, whether he would win the war. Sometimes you have to do things that you don't win, but you still have to do them. And if you turn to the next page, source number 5, you'll see the Rambam clearly says that it's that Shakol Divrei Torah Mitzvim Anu L'Asotam Ad Hayom, that all of the laws that we have a halacha of lo ba'shamayim hi, that we cannot learn from a prophet through some type of divine intervention. Nevertheless, we see in source number 6 a very interesting thing. In source number 6, we see that the land of Eretz Yisrael was given out in Lebriut. Was given out in a divine way. How was the land of Eretz Yisrael given out? Look at that Gemara for a second. How was the land of Eretz Yisrael given out? By? By a goral. What type of goral? Just a simple goral?
No.
Explain, please.
Divine.
A divine goral. Now, giving out land is a halachic issue, right? Who owns what land is a real halachic issue. So how can it be that land could be given out with a goral? Lo ba'shamayim hi. It's no longer in heaven. How could it be that all of the La'ela Techaleka Aretz how you're going to hand out the land is done al pi agarol techaleka aretz, through a lottery. And the Gemara explains it wasn't just a lottery; it was a divine lottery. It was a lottery that was done that Elazar, you know, would announce, I'm about to pick up, I'm about to pick up from the tribe of Zvulun, and then I'm about to pick out what boundary has, and it's this. And it was a magical lottery. How is that permitted? I could understand the lottery if you want to do it in a haphazard way. Fine, you want to do it that way, do it that way. But to do it through a divine way, that seems to be not consistent with the idea that we just said of Lo Bashamayim Hi. And then there's another thing, and that is that if you the Gemara indicates that the location of the Beis HaMikdash during the time in which they built the second Beis HaMikdash, they wanted to know exactly where the Mizbeach was and everything else of that nature. And the Gemara says that the Nevi'im that were left over, they through prophecy, or it seems to indicate they through prophecy, they through prophecy indicated exactly the location of where the Mizbeach was. So again, how can it be that the halachas of Shechita on the Beis HaMikdash were defined through prophetic activity? I thought Lo Bashamayim Hi again. So how can we allow there to be the use of divine intervention on issues of Eretz Yisrael, namely the location of the Beit HaMikdash, as well as the lotteries of the dividing of the land of Israel? Everyone understand that question? Everyone understand it? Does anyone get it? Anyone got it? Anyone have an answer?
Before this halakha ever reaches mankind, then, like, let's say they're Shamayim is Mashkiach over, the second it reaches mankind, then you don't go back to Shamayim.
Let me define what you're saying a little bit. What's your name?
Becky.
So I would define what Becky's saying slightly, and that is maybe while Moshe Rabbeinu was alive, so maybe we allow Shamayim to play a role, but once after Moshe Rabbeinu dies, that we don't allow Shamayim to play a role. And that's a very good answer. That could be one answer. Anyone have any other answers? That doesn't answer the part that for the second Beis HaMikdash they found the location of the Beis HaMikdash. That works for the Goral answer. It doesn't help us with the first answer, the first piece.
Not that necessarily only during Moshe's time, but meaning, for example, with the Tanur Shalachnai, it's not once the halacha has already entered the human realm in terms of discussion and machloka, you don't go back to Shamayim as, whose side do they take before it enters, like, man's arena.
Very nice. There are definitely people that would advocate that position. Anyone have any other answers? So Rav Kook deals with this question. Rav Kook on page 7, asks the question. Rav Kook says the following. Rav Kook says that normally Lo Bashamayim he applies, but in the Torah it says, Ki im al makom asher yivchar Hashem. Right, God will show you where the place is for you to l'shichnasho, for you to dwell, and for there to be the Beis HaMikdash. In other words, what Rav Kook says is, Lo Bashamayim Hi normally applies, but there are some times in which Lo Bashamayim Hi, divine intervention, gets a bye. Where does it get a bye? When the Torah already permits Lo Bashamayim Hi. Since the Torah says, Al pi agarol techaleka aretz, the Torah says that it's going to be done through a goral, through a magical goral, the Torah is basically saying, normally the halacha is Lo Bashamayim Hi, except for when the Torah permits it. Al pi agarol, the Torah permits it. The Torah says there's going to be a lottery of that type. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that kiyim al makom, that you want to know where you're supposed to worship me at the Beis HaMikdash, I will tell you where you're supposed to worship me. I will give you the directions. I'm allowing divine intervention to help define my location. And therefore, Rav Kook says that normally Lo Bashamayim Hi is not permitted. But in cases in which the Torah basically said, okay, normally the halacha is lo b'shamayim hi, but there's going to be a few exceptions, and the Torah is going to say what those exceptions are. Others say differently. Others say the fact that the Gemara says that the Nevi'im showed you where the second where the Mizbeach was doesn't mean they showed you through Nevuah. It means that the Nevi'im were Rabbanim. They were people who were around during the first base of Mikdash, and they remembered the geographical location of where the Mizbeach was. It wasn't done through Nevuah. But I think Rav Kook's idea, and the reason why I picked this, because there's hundreds of examples, and I'm not obviously doing all of them, Rav Kook's idea, the message that I want to communicate is that normally there is an idea of Lo B'Shamayim Hi. But there are exceptions to the rule, and we're going to see a few more exceptions. But the first exception to the rule is when the Torah itself says there's going to be an exception. Rav Kook says, the Torah says, Ki imam makom, I'm going to tell you where the Beis HaMikdash is going to be. I'm going to be involved. I'm going to drive that process. That means he's still involved in the process. I'm going to announce the Gorals. Therefore, he's still involved in the process. The few times where the HaKadosh Baruch Hu says he wants to still be involved in the process, Lo B'Shamayim, he doesn't apply. That's Rav Kook's answer. Let's look at source number 8 for a second. Source number 8 says the following. Let's say an individual lost his parents, and his parents tell him that I want you to know that he knows that his parents left him a pot of gold. He just doesn't know where it is. One day, one night, he has a dream and says, you know that pot of gold you're looking for? You should go up to the attic, go into the attic, go left, behind your high school textbooks, behind those notebooks that you should have thrown away a long time ago, that you're never going to look at again. Behind those things, you'll find a pot that has 30 pieces of gold in it. But I just want you to know, in those 30 pieces of gold, I dedicated those 30 pieces of gold to CJF. But they're right over there. He wakes up the next morning. He goes exactly there. He finds those old notebooks, exactly everything else. And sure enough, there's 30 pieces of gold. Does he have to give that money to the CJF or not? What do you think?
No.
No. Why not?
It's a dream.
Yeah, but the dream is true. It's exactly where it is.
Just because it's true doesn't mean that the dream was actually a form of Nevuah. It's a dream.
It's a true dream.
But just because the dream turns out to be true doesn't mean that it is from a form of truth.
I agree with you. The answer is no. Tragically, the answer is no. But let me ask you a question. Let's say we know the dream is 100% true. The answer still would be no.
Because the dream is from his own head.
Let's assume that dreams have some type of divine component to it. Still, the answer would be no. Why would the answer be no? Why still would the answer be no? You're right about the answer. I just want to make sure. Why is the answer no? It's not only no for the reason you just articulated. What? I'm sorry?
I just don't think you can remove from the fact that it's a... What you're trying to say, I think, is the fact that it's we don't decide halacha based on dreams.
We don't have any form of intervention.
But nevertheless, I don't think you can remove from the fact of dream that it's from himself.
Okay, so I want you to help me with the next with source number 10 for a second. Sorry, your name again.
Hannah.
Look at source 10. Here's source 10. Source 10 says the following. The person has a dream that he's put in cherem. Okay? The halacha is that when he wakes up, he has to find a group of people to remove him from the cherem. So according to what you said, Hannah, that it's a dream. It's coming from his head. We should not... Let's look at that source inside, source 10. Amar Rav Yosef, niduhu b'chalom, if he is put in cherem in his dream, sarach yud b'nei adam lahatir lo, he needs 10 people to remove him from that cherem. And by the way, the Shulchan Aruch in source 11 paskins that way. So I'm asking you a question, Hannah, and that is, it's from his own thing. Why would he need to
because
be?
Obviously, he feels that he should. If he's having a dream about it, it seems that he feels he should be in cherem, so he thinks he's done something wrong. So he needs to either justify himself to others or others to justify him.
No one knows about his dream. He's not sharing it with anybody.
No, but he seems, but it seems to be that because he has this guilt weighing on him, that he needs to go to others in order to alleviate himself.
Okay, so in other words, and so therefore, in the first case about the dream, the idea that he found the 30 pieces of gold exactly where the dream told him, and even though the money's supposed to be given to Tzedakah, so that's just a dream in his own mind, it has no validity to it, and the other dream that says he's in Cherem has validity
to
it.
I don't think either of them have validity, they just, I think it seems to be that he concluded subconsciously that that's where the gold must be, like maybe he feels it should be donated, but that doesn't mean that it's true, just as he feels he should be in Cherem, that doesn't mean it's true.
Okay. So Hannah's, you know, I'm not going to argue with Hannah's approach, but I wanted to take this in a slightly different way, place, and I'd like to put, which will basically come out on the same side of the street, so to say, but I wanted to just take it even one step further, and that is, there is a notion within the Jewish philosophy, within, that dreams have some parts that are true, that have some truth to it. There can be a Freudian component to dreams, as Hannah in some ways articulating. There can be other components to dreams, but dreams have some truth to it. So the question is, if there is a dream that a person found a pot of gold in the exact location where the dream tells them, and it's also designated as staka, it doesn't become staka. Because no form of divine intervention can create a haloshim, can create the status of a chetza, of an object of tztaka. Because again, of the notion of lo bashamayim hi. Lo bashamayim hi does not allow a dream, even if it has a divine component to it, it does not allow it to give the object a status of charity that would forbid you from having pleasure from it. That's consistent with the ideas that we had before. What is not consistent is this idea of how can you be put in cherem, how can you be excommunicated in a dream? If a dream is not supposed to have any form of status, why is it that there needs to be some form of nullifying the cherem that you put into in a dream? And by the way, if anyone gets put in the cherem tonight in a dream, keep in mind it's because of this conversation we're having today, so you don't have to worry about it. So the question is, why is that? So Hannah's point is actually a very good point. And it is an important point, and that is that normally dreams, even if they have a divine component to it, labriut, they do not create a halachic status whatsoever because of the notion of lo bashamayim hi. The exception is in this case of a cherem, because of the fact that the need to be released from this cherem that you receive in a dream is not because the dream has halachic teeth, because it can't, because of lo bashamayim hi, but because of the psychological concerns that we have with a person feeling that he's been put in a cherem. When a person feels that they've been put in a cherem, there's some type of angst that the person's going through that we want removed. So, for example, let me make this a little personal for a second. When I was, I know the exact time because I have a daughter who was born around that time. When I was around 16 years ago, I created a Vada Kashrus in Boca Raton, Florida. There was no kosher establishments whatsoever. No kosher meat, no kosher nothing. You couldn't buy even kosher bread in the stores. And we would go to Miami Beach, we would buy all our meats, we bought this big freezer type of thing. For our backyard, for our car, we would get meat from New York sent to us by FedEx, frozen, etc., etc. The Federation came to me, which was mamish glot treif. It was mamish. It was a community day school there in which there was meat that was answered to a higher authority, and they would serve sometimes cheese with the meat. So mamish, it was like basar v'chalav. And the Reform Conservative rabbis agreed that they wanted the Federation campus to go from being treif to being kosher. And they asked me to be in charge of the kashrus. So after discussing with Rav Schechter and others, I decided we were going to make this Federation campus kosher. And we worked out all the parameters of what we had to do. The first stage of making a Federation campus kosher, which is now 100 acres, but then was only 28, was we played kosher for the first 2 weeks. In other words, we only ordered kosher products, but the place was still treif. But we just ordered kosher products first. So I stopped the order from the meat that answers to a higher authority because it wasn't glot meat, it wasn't under the standards I was comfortable with. The person who gave supervision to that meat lived in Miami Beach. The guy who has a very long beard, a person who was in charge of all the Hebrew national kashrut, with the exception of the things that were under the OU, he was in charge of that meat. The head of Hebrew National calls him up and says, there's this young schnook, you know, who basically just canceled a major meat order to the Federation campus because it had a nursing home and other things. Help us out. The next week, on the front page of a Yiddish newspaper that comes out of Brooklyn, the Allgemeine Journal, there's a letter that says, on the front page, headlines, we warned the rabbi of Boca Raton not to work on kashrut with conservative reform. The rabbi of Boca Raton is officially in cherem. I get a call from the Satmar Beis Din letting me know that they're about to follow cherem procedures on me. This is all because one person decides that he doesn't want me to stop a meat order for meat that doesn't answer to a standard that's consistent with standards that we have in our home. At the end of the day, the Satmar Beis Din realizes that with thanks to the OU and others that what I was doing here wasn't anything that was scandalous, was just actually trying to create a standard of kashrut. And the bottom line is they apologize, buried in the Allgemeine Journal on page 26, and a thing that everybody here would also need a magnifying glass to read. They also apologize. And the bottom line is that there was a lot of pressure when you get calls about being put in cherem from a lot of different people. My wife actually went into premature labor over this. And Baruch Hashem, everything was fine, but it was a little dicey for a few days. So I got a few sets of phone calls when I was getting put in this cherem from some of my teachers. So my homiletics teacher, Rabbi Lookstein, called me up and says to me, you're not even 30 yet. You're getting put into cherem. You must be doing something great. You're getting put into cherem. Rabbi Riskin calls me and says, I'll teach you how to make money by being put in cherem. You know, there's benefits to this cherem thing. Trying to make me feel good. But the bottom line is, getting put to cherem before you're 30 is not something that you're excited about. You feel a certain pressure when someone suggests that you're going to be put in cherem. It's not something that you're excited about. So says the Shivat Zion, and source number 12, that while it's true that dreams, even unlike, and again, we're arriving in the same place that Hannah is taking us, but with a slightly extra component to it. And that is, most poskim say that dreams have a divine component to it. And the truth is that the divine component to it cannot create a halachic status because of lo bashamayim hi. And that's why that money cannot be considered money that's staka. So how can the person be considered in a cherem? The answer is that there is a psychological concern that the person being put in cherem is going to have, because he thinks in the dream that he's going to go through that he's being put in cherem, and we have to remove that psychological concern. But it's interesting, the Gemara in source number 10 and the Shulchan Aruch in source 11 reminds us that someone who's being put in cherem when they're in a dream doesn't need the same strict removal of the cherem. Normally you need a group of people who are learned people. In order to remove yourself from this cherem that you have in a dream, you need any 10 people, and the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch says they can be people who don't even know how to read Hebrew. They can be, in other words, they don't have to be Talmidei Chachamim. They can remove the cherem from you. In other words, the point that Hannah said, which is the point I want to mention, is the idea that, which is mentioned in source 12, and that is, the reason why the cherem has any teeth whatsoever, even though it's in a dream, and we paskin lo bashamayim hi, is simply because we were choshesh for the psychological concerns that the person may have, that the person feels that maybe he should be put in cherem or something else happened in his life, and therefore we want to extricate him from those feelings, and therefore we go through a process of removing the cherem. Not because it has a full halachic status of cherem. Yes?
Is it
like, let's say he says, like, I don't want to go through this. Like, I don't want to be.
We still make him go through it. It's not a complicated. We still make him. If he's going to share the dream, we make him go through it. I don't think he's in a formal cherem until he goes through it, but we still make him go through the process.
Like, you assume that if he shared it, it's obviously on his mind.
Right. The same way, the halacha is that if you have a barrel of water outside that's been uncovered, you can't use it to bake matzah for concerns that maybe something dropped into it that may be challenging. In other words, we're over the top when it comes to certain medical issues and certain psychological concerns. But my point is, I'm showing you a deviation, but the Rishonim and Achronim, like, they pounced on this deviation because Lo Bashamayim, he is the compass which choreographs their halachic issues. When something deviates from it, they really were bothered from it. And that's also found in Source 13. In Source 13, you have a situation of the following. In Source 13, you have a fish called the Barbutus fish. This fish had fins and scales, but when it came out of the water, it seems that some of the scales were lost. So Tosfos in Source 13 says, Tosfos says it's still a kosher fish because we have witnessed that has fins and scales in the water. It's called this Barbutus fish. And furthermore, the eggs that this fish lays are eggs of a kosher fish. There are different simanim of kashrus with fish. It's actually, there's a siman of kashrus also based on the type of eggs it lays, the shape of the eggs that it lays. That's Source 13. Along comes the Or Zeruah that says the following on the next page, Source 14. Ani hamachaber shamati mipi HaKadosh Rebbe Yehuda Chassid, that anyone she'amar b'loshon zeh, she'kol mi she'achal barbuta lo yiske le'achol livyatan. Anyone who's going to eat the barbuta's fish will not have a place in the world to come, will not eat of the livyatan, which is the fish that is served in the world to come. I remember the president, Richard Joel, had the Rosh Yeshivas over for a dinner. So he served sushi, and he made a comment to everybody that there was more sushi consumed when the Rosh Yeshivas were there than when other people were there. So Rabbi Tendler responded, and that's because it's less of a problem to eat non-kosher fish than it is to eat non-kosher meat. So there's this joke that the Livyatan is served in Olam Haba. Because who's going to trust anyone else's hashgacha? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides to obviate the problem and only serve fish. So this idea is that in the world to come, says Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, that if anyone eats from the barbuta's fish, which Tosfos says is permitted, you won't have a place in the world to come. Why? Because there is Rav Ephraim Bar Yitzchak, who had a dream one time. Listen to this dream, Hannah. Into dreams. That one time, he had a dream, and in front of him, and there's two versions of this story. One is that his father-in-law, and he sees his father-in-law in his dream, and one version is he just has this dream, and he gets a plate of shratzim. He gets a plate of worms. And he says, how could you serve me this plate of worms? And then he wakes up from his sleep, and he realizes that he permitted the barbuta's fish to be eaten. And therefore, from this, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid says that anyone who eats the barbuta's fish doesn't have a place in the world to come. So because some dream that some gadol had, you're going to totally destroy what the Balei HaTosfos said was permitted, the barbuta's fish. So the Noda Yehuda in Source 15 goes ballistic. What a crazy absurdity is this? And a dream can deviate from halacha? Lo bashamayim hi. You cannot allow a dream to do this. And maybe Rav Ephraim paskined a different halacha wrong that day. And that's why he got that rodent-filled dish. Not because of the barbuta's fish. You have the Balei Tosfos that have gone through a halachic process saying the barbuta's fish is permitted. You don't have a right to go against what the Balei HaTosfos said. You cannot use dreams to interpret in any way a halacha in any way, shape, or form. So I'm trying again to show you these ideas. I want to now show you a few other interesting ideas. Source 16 is the Ravid in many, many places which makes the following comments. I just gave you one. For example, Kfar Hofia Ruach HaKodesh v'Beit Midrashenu, that thank God I've come to this conclusion because I had Ruach HaKodesh in my Beis Medrash that told me this halacha. Or v'hakol barur v'chibareinu v'makom hinichu li nashamayim, that Hashem guided me that this is what the Pesach is. Some people use these types of idioms as a proof that you can use divine intervention. Maybe using, I think, what Becky said earlier, and that is that maybe before the halacha comes down and has the conversation amongst the rabbis, you do allow divine intervention to play a role. So Dr. Tversky, in his famous, yes?
So about Ruach HaKodesh, Ruach HaKodesh doesn't necessarily have to connote, meaning, like, doesn't Ruach HaKodesh generally stem from the fact that someone's on such a high level that one would call it Ruach, like, it's not so clear.
So Dr. Tversky writes that he doesn't even, you have to go that far. He says these are idioms from the Middle Ages. These are idioms that the Ravid used. He shows that it means like, gee, I got it. In other words, you know, I'm really focused the right way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu helped me. It doesn't mean that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him divine intervention. It doesn't mean that. It means something totally different. It means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu empowered me to come to that conclusion. But not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually answered the question for me. That's not what it means. In other words, the idioms should not be viewed literally. And he discusses it in the piece that I gave you. And he shows, and you can read his piece on the Ravid. Everyone should read that piece. You should read this piece on the Ravid. And he explains that these are idioms from that period of time, not to be taken literally. What's very interesting is, if we turn to the next page, we actually see two halakhas from the Shulchan Aruch. And in source 19, we see the Magen Misharim. Does anyone know who the Magen Misharim is? What the Magen Misharim is? Anyone know what it is? Anyone? There's this conversation, and we have from the Rav Shlomo Alkabates and others that Rav Yosef Cairo would have conversations with a Maggid, some type of divine spirit that would have a conversation that would enter into Rav Yosef Cairo. You had conversations with him, and there are letters written that people witness these conversations, especially in Tikkun Leil Shavuos. There's a letter on it and something of that nature. So you have Rav Yosef, and by the way, there are people who are furious when they do that because they say you're destroying the authenticity of Rav Yosef Cairo, because Rav Yosef Cairo is the greatest codifier of Jewish law. How can they be involved in such divine ideas, divine things? It takes away from his integrity as a halachas. But I want to show you something very interesting. And two examples, there are a few, I just wanted to show you two. Most scholars suggest that if whoever the Magen Misharim was, that it was probably Rav Yosef Cairo. So you have Rav Yosef Cairo who writes this diary of his conversation with this divine being, and Rav Yosef Cairo writes the Shulchan Aruch. What's interesting is the following. Rav Yosef Cairo has an ill child, and he decides on Rosh Hashanah, he decides that he's going to fast on the second day of Rosh Hashanah and not on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Why? Because since Rosh Hashanah is a Yom HaRichta, that if he fasts on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, for the rest of his life, he has to fast both on the first day of Rosh Hashanah and the last day of Rosh Hashanah for the rest of his life. He doesn't want to do that. Because even though you normally not allowed to fast on a Chag, Rosh Hashanah is the exception. Some have the minhag of fasting. It's not the normative minhag. Some have the minhag of fasting. So if Yosef Cairo decided, I had this bad dream, I'm not going to ignore the bad dream. I'm going to, something's going to happen. He has this dream that something's going to happen to his son. So he decides he's going to fast on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, so the rest of his life he only has to fast on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, not on both days of Rosh Hashanah. The Maggid says to him, you're wrong. If you fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the rest of your life you only have to fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. You don't have to fast on both days of Rosh Hashanah. That's what he tells him. Don't wait till the second day of Rosh Hashanah to fast. Fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. The rest of your life, you only have to fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. You don't have to fast on the first and second day of Rosh Hashanah. Even though the Maggid tells him this, and he writes this down, if you look at source 19, the first source is on a chalom that he has, and that he's told that he should fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah and the rest of his life he only has to fast on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. In source 18, Sif Gimel, even though the Magid tells him what the halacha is, look at what Rav Yosef Karo, who wrote the Magid Misharim, writes in Sif Gimel in source 18. Hamas'ana pam achas for Rosh Hashanah tanis chalom. If someone fasts on the first, on one day, on Rosh Hashanah once, for tanis chalom, im haya b'yom rishon, if it was on the first day, tzarech l'shanos shnei yamin kol yamav. He has to fast both days all his life. Im haya b'yom sheni, if he was on the second day, he's ana kol yamav, yom sheni bavad. So on the second day, he only has to fast on the second day all his life. So here you have Yosef Karo being told by some divine source what the halacha is. Then you have Rabbi Yosef Karo going through the halachic process, going through the Gemara, going through the halachic process, and he decides against what the divine source that he writes down, he decides against it. Because you cannot use divine sources to define halacha. And you see that in another place also. Rabbi Yosef Karo writes that you should say Amen three times in Kaddish, and even though the Magid says you should say it five times, and in the second source he speaks about how you should say Amen five times in Kaddish, nevertheless, even though the Magid says then you're supposed to say Amen five times, when he writes his code of Jewish law in source 17, he only says you're supposed to say Amen three times. Again, here's an example where the same individual had the capacity to live a healthy schizophrenic lifestyle. That is, as a halachist and as a Kabbalist. He was a Kabbalist and a halachist. But he didn't allow the Kabbalistic piece to affect his halachic piece because of the notion of Lov HaShemayim. Unless we think that Rabbi Yosef Karo is the only one like that, yes, please.
Just as a little bit off the topic, but in terms of, is that just for Rosh Hashanah that it can fast on Rosh Hashanah? That means we'd have to fast the rest of your life like that, or is that...
No, it's just Rosh Hashanah.
Just
Rosh Hashanah, because Rosh Hashanah is a unique day, because it's a Yom HaDin, it's a day of Yontif, so those who accept the minhag of fasting, it becomes like, since it's a bona fide minhag, once you start it, you have to do it for the rest of your life. It's interesting, there is a sefer on Kabbalah that the Vilna Gaon wrote called Safra Detzinuta. Now, the Vilna Gaon had Rav Chaim was the Vilna Gaon's Talmud. Rav Chaim of Elazhin writes a comment, an introduction to the Safra Detzinuta, this Kabbalistic Sefer of the Vilna Gaon. So the first two lines are the Hebrew, the first two paragraphs are Hebrew, and this is a translation that I typed up just for this, for our learning together. Okay? Well, let me just say what it says in here to begin with. Now, again, the Vilna Gaon, Rav Chaim, was not known for exaggerations. Chaim of Elazhin was not known for exaggerations. He writes the following. My Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, studied very, very hard. And there's all these stories about how when he, you know, was involved in his own learning, studied very, very hard. He says there were times in which, when he was struggling over a sugya, halachic issue, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to send down Magidim to tell him what the halacha was. And the Vilna Gaon would shoo them away and would say, I don't want to have anything to do with you. I only want to understand what my intellect allows me to understand. I will not allow my knowledge of Torah to be compromised by what you, the angels, will share with me. The only time he allowed the angels to share with him issues was when they were dealing with issues of philosophy and Kabbalah, but not when they were dealing with issues of halacha because of the notion of Lov HaShemayim. This is what Rav Chaim writes. This is not, again, some, you know, Kalabachian Kabbalist. This is Rav Chaim. This is like, you know, this is a person who's not known for exaggerations. And more than anything, this is the Vilna Gaon's greatness and his awesomeness, for he only revealed his soul to feel the goodness which is only felt when it toils with the struggles of wisdom, knowledge, and intelligence. Only after his great struggles for Torah knowledge, and when the heavens had mercy upon him and revealed to him the wellsprings of knowledge known as Radar and deep secrets, this allowed him to attain the knowledge of Tiferet Elohim. However, except for this learning of Kabbalah, his soul was not interested in the angels teaching him Torah. When they, the angels, wanted to tell him from heaven the pearls of wisdom, Farah, without him having to struggle and toil, and to be told the secrets of up high, through the angels who had mastered the mysteries and the princes of Torah, he did not pay attention to them and distance himself from them. Let's look at the second paragraph. Second paragraph in the Hebrew. Ki shamati mipi hakadosh. I heard from the hakadosh as the Divan Gaon. Shepa amim rabos hishkimu l'toach kama magidim min hashamayim. That sometimes magidim would come from the heavens. Bishal tem b'gashim shirotzim solo rozen. Daraisa below shum azna. Shum amal. Wanted to teach them the secrets without any type of toil. Below hita azna alehem klal. He would not listen to them, the Vilna Gaon. Echadna magidim hipsalom ha'od. One of the magidim was very, very obstinate. In kozel lo gibit el marei ha'gadol. He wouldn't look at his great vision. Va'ana, he would respond. Va'amr lo, eini rotze she'tiyah hashkati v'torato yisvarach ayidei shum emsa'i klal uklal. I do not want my knowledge of Torah to be given over to me by any type of medium. Rock a nine to suot lo, Yisparach Masharotza Lagalotli. Only my eyes should, Hakash Baruch Hu should give me what my eyes allow me to understand. Velitin Chalki Basaraso Yisparach Ba'amali Esha Amalti B'Kochi. What my intellectual ability will be able to understand, what I'll be able to understand, only that do I want. He would shoo them away. Again, highlighting, I mean, again, I'm using texts that are very, out of the ordinary, but to prove a point. I mean, again, these are not. I am a strong. My heart is very much in the gunim of Rabbi Kalaba. So I wasn't trying to be chas v'shalom negative. I'm just trying to say we're talking about Rav Chaim writing about the Vilna Gaon, about these magidim that would appear and that he would refuse to allow them to give him any type of guidance because lo b'shamayim mi b'torah. However, we do see that there are situations in which, and the hour is late, so, and I want to sum up because I want to have some time for us to have a conversation. So I'm going to do this outside, and you can follow it on your own. We do see something, and I want to close, and I need around 7 minutes or so. Okay. There are a few different cases in the Gemara. I'm just going to give one example of them. But it seems that divine intervention plays a role. For example, there's one Gemara that says the following. Let's say the child of a Kohen and the child of a Kohen's maidservant get mixed up. You don't know which one is the maidservant's child and the Kohen's child. This is before genetic testing, if anything. Okay, so the halacha is that they both cannot be metame to a mace. They both cannot eat truma. You have the chumras. They both have the chumras of both. And obviously, since we don't know one's a kohen, he can't eat truma or anything else like that. But the Gemara says, when Eliyahu Hanavi comes, Eliyahu will be able to decide which one is the kohen's child and which one is the maidservant's child. Which one's the servant's child? How could that be? Based on Eliyahu, we're going to decide who does avodah in the Beis Hamikdash. And then the question that I mentioned to you before, which is found in source 22, where the Nevi'im pointed out where the Mizbeach was. Now, we gave one answer already. We gave a few answers. But again, the question is, how could the Nevi'im decide where the Mizbeach is? Lo b'shamayim hi. And there are several cases in the Gemara where we see when there is an issue of metzias, of defining a reality, that we allow divine intervention to play a role. But we've said heretofore that divine intervention cannot play a role. And if that's the case, how do we see, for example, in the case of the child, the two children that are mixed up, how do we see that it is permitted for nevuah to play a role? Help me solve this question, and then we can move on to our conclusion. Yes?
Well, that's not very practical, because saying, oh, when Eliyahu comes, he'll tell us, does that really have to do anything with reality right now? It's more of like, you know, there is an answer somewhere, and we'll find it, you know, one of these days later.
Okay,
like,
but that's interpreting this Gemara. It's a very nice way. But the Gemara still says, for example, there's another case where Tosfos brings down that there's a Shiloh where Shlomo HaMelech built a throne for himself, and it had lions on the throne, and there's a whole Shiloh whether that's an issue of making an idol. And the answer is they were used of the lions, these stone lions, because when a false witness would come in front of Shlomo, these stone lions would roar, and Shlomo HaMelech would know which Edom were truthful Edom and which Edom were not truthful Edom. That's what Tosfos says. So again, lo bashamayim hi, how could you allow there to play a role? Just four or five examples of the same issue. You can't dismiss them all with that answer. Yes.
Maybe the time
that
it's going to
dash from Mashiach, it's going to change. No, we can't. Halacha is halacha. You can't say it's just whatever. There's a halacha process. We just talked about the halacha process. The time of Beis Hamikdash doesn't change, and the time of Mashiach doesn't change. It doesn't change. We're part of a halacha process.
There's a difference. I think you mentioned it before. There was a tzius here. One of these children was a Kohen, and one wasn't. But there was something that Hashem is calling a Kohen here, Kfar Hashem. Something that he's calling Nafla, but the other pieces, like Tanur Shalachnai, it's not that the Tanur is, it's not that something happened and it's Tamei or it's Tahor, it's that we don't know what category to put it in, and it's the Halacha that's supposed to determine that, not.
Okay.
Right.
Wonderful answer. Mishnah Melech answers exactly the way you can answer. Mishnah Melech says there's two different paradigms in Halacha. There's a paradigm of searching for truth. You want to know what the status is with this reality. I have a piece of meat I find in the street. I want to know if it's kosher or not. Now, if I don't know if it's kosher or not, there's a Shulchan Aruch that discusses the whole notion of meat found in the street. But if Eliyahu Hanavi, came and said, "I'm telling you this meat's kosher," fine, because it's a din in the metzias. It's a shaila in the reality, the status of this reality. I know one of these children is the child of a Kohen. I know one is a child of a maidservant. I just don't know who's whom, right? I know that these witnesses, some are truthful, some are not truthful. I'm not asking the lions to make the decision. I just want to be able to filter out the metzias of who is telling me the truth and who's not telling me the truth. In all of those cases, it's not that Nebuah is not truthful. It's that Nevuah represents an idea that Nevuah is truthful, but we do not allow it to play a role in the halachic process when we're defining the reality. Who's the mother of a child when there is one mother that gives the genetic gift of the egg and another mother who nurtures the fetus within the womb? That's not a halacha in Metzius. That's a halacha in defining the definition of what a mother is. That you can't use Eliyahu for. That's what the Tanur Achnai case is. It's a definition in how do you define this object, this oven. Is it a vessel or is it not a vessel? There, Eliyahu, there, Shamayim, there, God cannot play a role. But when it's a suffix in Metzius, when it's an issue in defining reality, then we do allow Nevuah to play a role, because it's not that Nevuah is not truthful. It just cannot create a halachic status. It cannot allow us to create a status for an object in which we're trying to search for how it fits into a halachic category. But when it's a din in Metzius, when it's a din in reality, then we do allow Nevuah to play a role. And that's the normative answer found throughout all the poskim. Let me just end with the following. Why is that? Why don't we allow Nevuah to play a role within a halacha process? I mean, after all, if halacha is about searching for the truth, and God wants to weigh in on the issue of which is the mother of the child, or whether the Tanur Achnai is Tamei or Tahar, if we're in the search for truth, should we not allow HaKadosh Baruch Hu to play a role? Is there any being that represents truth more than HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And as we've all seen, we do not allow God to play a role. The Vilna Gaon said to God, "Take a hike. I want to figure out your Torah on my own." Right? The Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo
said, listen, it's nice, I'm writing a diary of everything you taught me as a Kabbalist, but if it's not found in the lens of my Talmudic development, I will not include it in my Shulchan Aruch. And that's only going to be found in my Magid Misharim for some crazy guy who wants to read my Magid Misharim. It's not going to be found in my Shulchan Aruch. I thought we're interested in the truth. Why aren't we searching for it? So I'd like to suggest the following. When my wife and I got married, we had a wonderful opportunity. It was bittersweet. A wonderful opportunity, not the marriage, this opportunity, and that is, Rabbi Soloveitchik was our Masada Kedusha. That's a sweet piece. The bitter piece is that it was the last public event that he had to attend. It was our wedding, and after that, he was very frail. Then it was after our wedding was at Marina Del Rey, which we actually picked because we knew he was coming and it has really no steps. We got married outside there, and he was Masada Kedushin. It was weird because you know, Marina Del Rey still has that long like thing, and like no one was sitting down because everyone wanted to hear what Rabbi Soloveitchik was saying, because so I was afraid someone was going to fall into the water there. And the caterer hired his own photographer so he could have pictures. So I had two photographers fighting with each other and two videographers. Imagine, for those of you who have gone through the process, what the challenge is. But at the end of the thing, instead of us going to the Yichud room, we spent a few minutes with Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he wished us mazel and bracha, and I, you know, it was an interesting chuppah because it was more of a sheer slash conversation part of the chuppah. It was great also because, you know, I asked like five people to speak underneath my chuppah, and they all said no, because who's going to speak? I asked Rabbi Blau to speak, and the Rav's there, how am I going to speak? So Rabbi Blau felt, I gave him a kibbutz, then I asked the next person, the next person, like five kibbutzim without anyone, but no one wanted to speak because the Rav's there. So, what happens is that I made some type of comment. I hope Rebbe will join us when we meet some of children, and Rebbe will come to the Shalom Zachar and to the Paris and whatever else. I don't know what, you know, why I said this thing. And he said to me, as he would always say, he says, if I'm invited, I'll come. And he said, but just remember, don't serve chickpeas at the Shalom Zachar. That's what he said. I thought it was some type of joke. I laughed, and that was it. We went back to the wedding. Rabbi Soloveitchik went back to Yeshiva University. And then we eventually had our first child was a boy. And then I remember this thing that Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I need the chuppah. After the chuppah, don't have chickpeas. So I started actually thinking about it then. So I looked at it, and it says, one of the notes that Caleb says, the Taz says, the whole idea of chickpeas is that chickpeas are around food. It's a zecher to the fact that the Gemara says that a child learns in utero all of Torah. When they're born, the child gets the Torah. Therefore, she has chickpeas to as a mourning of the fact that the child forgot all of his Torah. Just to remind you of that. Then I read. Then I remembered an article of Rabbi Soloveitchik where he writes that one would think that this is a tragedy that the child has forgotten all of the Torah, but it's actually just a beautiful thing because it really celebrates the idea that in Judaism we are all victims of amnesia. That our Torah is not a new experience, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us to chart our own course with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That we're supposed to learn our own Torah, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't give it to us spoon-fed. Yes, we learn it in utero, but we forget it. We have a whiteboard to start off with, a clean whiteboard to start off with, and it's now our opportunity to be able to learn Torah and to find our own path, our own relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is trying to do for us. And I said, oh, that's what he was trying to tell me. That joke wasn't a corny joke. He really meant it. He said, don't serve chickpeas. Because you know what? The fact that your child has forgotten all the Torah that lived in utero isn't a sad thing. It's an unbelievable thing. That your child now has the ability, hopefully with the help of his parents, to have this unbelievable odyssey. Your daughter now has this unbelievable opportunity to have this unbelievable odyssey to study Torah. And that you have to really celebrate that thing and not mourn for it. Don't serve chickpeas. By the way, I looked at the Bir HaGrah there, who brings on the same minhag to have Shalom Zachar, but does not bring down the minhag to have chickpeas. And so, when my mother came to the Shalom Zachar with a ton of chickpeas, I explained to her that we were going to have chickpeas for lunch, and not at the Shalom Zachar. But I think that that's the message here. I think that the message here is, Rosh Hashanah indeed is all about the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the opportunity to guarantee the future of Torah through our own commitment to Torah. And if Torah is spoon-fed to us, then we don't have that commitment. If a Magid could tell the Vilna Gaon how to paskin the Shaila, if a Magid could tell the Shulchan Aruch, the Rav Yosef Karo, how to influence his text, then it compromises the whole idea that we have the capacity to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's partners in the creation of the next development of Torah. It says, V'chol Yisrael ro'im et kolot et alapidim. And everyone asks the Shaila, how could you see kolot? If you look at the Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel, he says, what does it mean, V'chol Yisrael ro'im et kolot by Matan Torah? At this point in which the whole Jewish people were unified, every single Jew saw his own sound, his own special rendezvous with God. Ro'im et kolot. Every Jew, v'chol ha'am ro'im et kolot, every Jew saw their own kol, their own voice, their own special relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every Jew was able to engage and find their own special voice. That's the unbelievable thing about learning. Talmud Torah is about us all finding our own voice, our own connections with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not about, God forbid, mourning the fact that we lost Torah. It's about the opportunity to learn Torah again. And therefore, the last words I'd like to leave you with is that first source. I'd like to look at that first source again. The first source says the following. Ash b'chei Rav Nassan Eliyahu. Last two lines of the first source. Rabbi Nassan turned to Eliyahu v'amale and said to him, my other kucha b'richu b'hashayta. What is God doing at this moment? What is God doing at this moment when he lost the battle with the rabbis? Amrale kachayach, God is laughing or smiling. Now we translated the first time that my children have won, which is a fine translation. I'd like to translate it a different way. Nitzchuni b'nai nitzchuni is my children have immortalized me. My children have immortalized me. The minute my children are equally involved in the halachic process, that guarantees the eternality and the immortality of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That guarantees the immortality of what Yadus is all about. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was saying. My Ovid, what was HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing at that time? HaKadosh Baruch Hu recognized the minute that Lo Vashemayim he is taken seriously, then what happens is we become part of the process. And while we benefit by that, but also HaKadosh Baruch Hu benefits. It allows HaKadosh Baruch Hu to guarantee that the bris with Knesset Yisrael continues on because we become stakeholders. And I think that's what you guys are doing here. You're becoming stakeholders. Your commitment to your own personal growth, but the reason why that we're invested in this, and quite honestly, we invest more in this Beit Midrash than we do in any other summer program that we have. This one costs us more dollars than any other one. It's for one reason only. And that is, I'm hoping that this works. And that is, I'm counting on it. Because it's making the most important statement possible. And that is that we need to find venues in which both men and women have the opportunity to grow in their relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And to use the study of Torah as that conduit. It's not about taking out ads. It's not about a feminist agenda. It's not about anything of that nature other than the agenda that we just read about, and that is the idea of Nitzchuni B'nai Nitzchuni. I want to guarantee the immortality of the Kadosh Baruch Hu, then allow Torah and the bris of Torah to be shared by people all over the place, and you will guarantee that Nitzchias. And hopefully, that's what we are celebrating in our learning, and hopefully that's what we're celebrating in our commitment to guaranteeing the nitzchias through our intellectual development. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu imposed upon himself Lo Vashemayim Hi. He's not involved in the halakha process. You want to ask me a shayla about mitzvahs? I'll weigh in on it. But ask me a shayla about halakhic development, after I've given you the paradigms and the principles in halakha, it's now your choice, your responsibility to take halakha, to take our experience to the next level.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Immediately multiple